brought to you by Black Knight. It's the technology.ie podcast, episode 35 for Thursday, July 5th, 2012, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinicho.
Hello.
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 Good evening, Nacho. Nacho, you're on with myself and Calm.
Hi, Calm.
Hi, Nacho. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Welcome to the technology.ie podcast.
Thank you very much.
You're being recorded.
Have you actually started the recording, Calm?
Yeah, we're recording. We can fire away if you like.
Perfect. Well, I thought I'd kind of hijack Nacho very quickly since he was online and we didn't have a guest lined up this evening. So I thought, as we're doing a special promotion on .cat and Nacho works for .cat, why not get Nacho on to tell us a little bit about .cat?
Glad to be here, Michele.
You know, listeners won't believe this, but this has not been rehearsed. This has just happened while we were speaking. It's the first I heard about it. Nacho, are you doing something else that we are interrupting or disturbing you?
Actually, I'm having dinner, but I'm glad to have my dinner along with this nice talk with you guys.
Michaela, you owe this guy. You're interrupting his dinner.
No, it's light dinner. No problem. Well, I was checking email and talking with Michaela on Skype as well, so no problem.
Okay, we were just getting ready to record the show, Nacho, and I was looking at what we're going to talk about on the show this evening, and Michaela normally talks about a promotion or something to do with Black Knight and various domains and hosting deals that they offer. And this week, it turns out that he's doing a special offer on .cat, and I said, what is .cat? I never heard of it. And he said, hang on a second, I'll call Nacho. So what is .cat?
Welcome. .cat is a GTL that was created in 2006 to serve the needs of the Catalan linguistic and cultural community. Probably some of your listeners know about Catalonia, Catalan, which is the language which speak here, a romantic language. Very close to French and Spanish. You know Barcelona very well. We thought that the language as such didn't have a proper representation on the internet, and it was being underserved by the existing TLDs. So it was just, you know, a good way to get a brand and an identity online. And so far, we believe that it is working well. It could do better, but along with the help of people like Michele, we hope that this year and with this promotion, it's going to, you know, go a step forward in size, volume, and that's it.
Very good.
You've got over 50,000 domains registered now, don't you?
Yeah. Which is a bit below of where we believe we should be, but it's not bad, because one of the things about .cat is that volume, of course, matters, because that's where the income to sustain the rest, the people working for the registry comes from, so people like me can get a wage. But apart from volume, one of the main points in .cat is content, because it doesn't have a content requirement as such, but it is required that if there is some content, it has to be at least part of it in Catalan. So we really encourage the use of .cat for real content, because we believe that it also, you know, brings to the internet many things that the people wouldn't be doing otherwise. Does it make sense?
It does, indeed. I'm just looking at the blog post, Michaela, that you've put up in relation to this. And, of course, you've featured one of the Black Knight mascots in particular, appropriately enough, Squishy the Cat, who's astonished to discover that .cat has nothing to do with him. And so... But But you're offering a promotion on this, Michele, and it's the next 300.cat domain names registered via Black Knight will be available at the discounted price of €9.99 for a 1 year registration. How much are they normally, Nacho, or Michele, should I ask you perhaps?
About €25.
Okay. Okay. So, and you go on the website to explain that there has to be an intention to use Catalan on the website that is registered with a .cat domain. It's .cat. Is that what you say? That's the Catalan for .dot, is it?
That's it.
Yeah, it's like Irish actually. It's punk .ponc is a similar would be Irish for .dot.
Really?
People, yeah, it is. So punk cat in this case or something like that. But Nacho, it's interesting because so essentially it's cultural, it's linguistic, it's nationalistic, I suppose, or it is in some way referring to Catalan culture, Catalan the Catalan people and the Catalan language in particular. And who has imposed that condition? Is that imposed by yourselves, or was it part of the condition for getting the top level domain in the first place?
It's both come. It was part of the deal with Icon, but it was also the main intention of the idea behind creating the domain name. It is related to language and culture, and I would be more careful about using the term nationalism because you know it's quite controversial.
Indeed.
Depending on how it's used. But of course, it is. Related to the idea of identity and of showing and promoting your identity and making it known to others. Although we try to be quite differentiated from the political arena,
right,
because we are an independent non-for-profit, not related whatsoever to any political parties or any concrete government. And one of the main points is to make .cat as transversal as possible in order to reach out to anybody that wants to use it. So relationship with identity exists because this is one of the key features of the TLD, but without us taking a stand on what is your idea or your usage of the TLD.
So I guess it is important, and I think a lot of people who speak perhaps languages which may not be the dominant language in the country they live in would see it as very important. And I know as an Irish speaker and someone who's involved in Irish cultural activities in Ireland, where English dominates in this country, as Spanish does, I suppose, in yours, Nacho, it is important. That it is an opportunity that we have on the internet, is it not, to express our cultural identities in a way which I suppose in a virtual way, but in a no less meaningful way, all the same.
Absolutely, and as Michele knows, and he's been following. Well, you know, he's very, very. Involved in participation inside ICANN and the internet governance and the industry as a whole. There's a lot of new initiatives coming with this new GTLD round process that are somehow replicating what .cat did. And they are, well, you have the Galicians, the Bretons, the Scottish are also applying for a .scot, the Basque country, and well, many other people all over Europe that want to replicate the experience of what .cat is doing. So you see, there's the need, there's the market, and there are some people that are joining a force to offer this you know, this symbol or this new branding and opportunity for their identities.
I guess the whole nature of the internet and the way we can have multiple connections and we don't have to, it's not, you know, it's not serial. It's for example, if you're looking for media on a TV station, you cannot have a Spanish program and a Catalan program on the same channel at the same time. On the internet, however, we don't have those kind of problems, those kind of issues. We can all choose our language. We can all choose our culture. We can all choose what kind of media and what kind of expression and what kind of of activity we want at a particular time. Contrary to what some people might have thought, this technology and the internet really promotes diversity, and in a way that we've never been able to do before.
I can't add anything more to what you said, because I believe that this is this is the main point of it. DotCat is not created to go against nothing. It is just representing some people that want to use it and to what they believe it stands for. Nothing more than that.
And they don't. They don't have to be in Catalonia either.
There's no geographical requirement. The only requirement is that some part of it needs to be in Catalan, but you don't have to be based here. Actually, one of the things we try to convince people from abroad is that they can also use .cat to target the Catalan market, because it is a way to engage the customers they might end up having here with the vehicle that they are familiar with.
And remind us, Nacho, please, how big is that market?
Well, it depends, because the size of the Catalan speaking community goes beyond what is Catalonia, because there are speakers in the Balearic Islands,
that's right,
in Valencia, and some in the border of France, because it was in the Middle Ages they spoke Catalan there. So I would say it's between 10 and 12 million people that use Catalan in a daily basis.
That's three times the population of Ireland.
It is, and many times the number of people who use Irish, I think, on a daily basis. But that is beside the point in this particular case. But Michele, I want to ask you, what is an Irish domain registrar and hosting company doing selling .cat?
Well, that's a good question to ask, Colm. And of course, I'd be happy to answer it. The thing for us is .cat speaks to Catalan speakers, and there's over 12 million of them, which is it's a big market. So as an Irish registrar based in an island in the west of Europe, we can't compete head on with the mega hosters and mega registrars from the US or even some of the big European conglomerates. But we're able to offer these kind of domain extensions and services. I mean, we even have, I think our webmail is even available in Catalan. And that to us is, gives us a slight competitive advantage. And one thing that Nacho didn't mention, I think he's being very modest, is that he's actually, you're the chair, aren't you, of ECLID? Nacho?
Yes, I am indeed.
And say, Nacho is very modest. ECLID is... ECLID is this kind of loose umbrella organization for a lot of the cultural linguistic new TLD applicants. So, I mean, obviously .cat already have their domain extension, but they're joined by the guys from .bzh, which would be for Brittany and Breton speakers, .eus for EUS for the Basque Country, .gal for Galicia, and .scot for, Scotland. But there's several other cultural linguistic extensions that aren't involved in ECLID at the moment. So there's also the one for Wales, and what other ones are there, Nacho? I think there's a couple, one or two others knocking around.
Yeah, you have Friesland in the Netherlands with a quite strong sense of identity, culture, not so sure about the strength of the language, but still they are running quite a serious application. Then you have some regions in France, but they are, a different beast, because they will be more based on geographic basements than on cultural and linguistic. We have some over Germany, don't we?
I'm not sure. I mean, we've been examining a lot of the extensions that have been applied for on .watt.co, but there isn't an easy way to kind of split out the cultural linguistics. I mean, some of them, I think there's a dot Aquitaine, there's a dot
Alsace.
There's a dot Alsace. Let me have a look, actually. There's a dot Brussels, a dot Budapest.
There's a dot Flanderen for Flanders.
Yeah.
There's a big one for dot Quebec, and that is going to be big. That is going to be, I believe, is going to be one of the most successful in terms of registrations. Because it's a big market,
yeah.
No point in talking about this sense of identity because you know that they are French speakers. And I think it's going to be very, very eagerly adopted by almost everybody there.
I'm getting the impression, I'm getting the picture here, Michele, in this new world of many many new generic top-level domains and many new ways of identifying and expressing your cultural identity online. Black Knight, yourselves as a company, see this as an opportunity to, I suppose, to be a place to shop for the discerning domain hunter. Would that be a fair way to put it? Or just that you're going to, as you say, you won't compete with the with your large registrars. But if you want something special in a domain, if you want a domain that suits you, Black Knight is aiming to be the place to go. Is that it? And in a European and an international context, not just an Irish one.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I would look at it more in terms of serving a community, serving businesses, serving international businesses that want to enter those markets. Mm. I mean, ultimately, a domain name is just an entry in a database. I mean, sure, some of us who eat, sleep, and breathe it can get a bit carried away and start thinking of it as being a lot more than what it actually is. But I mean, yeah, that's you know, there are domainers, which, I mean, we've spoken to them in the past, who get terribly excited about domain extensions. And sure, I'll do that too. But, I mean, you know, the thing is, if you're a Catalan speaker, at the moment, you know, there's only a certain number of registrars that will get the carry.cat domains. In the future, when you have extensions such as .Africa or I'm just looking at a list here, .Zulu, for example, there isn't going to be a huge number of registrars. I mean, I'd hope there would be a reasonable number, but, you know, just offering the domain by itself is kind of pointless. Because you can't do anything with a domain. I mean, you can't even frame it and put it on the wall. I mean, it's completely intangible. You can't use it for anything. So, you know, it's the other services that go with that, Con, that make it all the more interesting.
Mm. Yep.
So what's for dinner in Barcelona this evening, Nacho?
Well, not much. Some cheese, some ham. You know, it was a late dinner because I've been working. It's been quite a long day. So I was just chatting with Michele and thought, okay, I'm going to grab a beer, something to munch, and keep here sitting on the chair in front of the computer.
Well, I got to say, we appreciate you joining us this evening, Nacho, and interrupting your meal. And,
My pleasure. Thanks to you and to Michele for offering me the possibility to even talk more about .cat.
Very good. All right.
Well, thanks very much, Nacho. And how do you say good evening in Catalan?
Bona nit.
Okay, bona what?
Bona nit.
Bona nit. Okay.
Ihava, Nacho, from Ireland. Ihava. Good night.
Ihava. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Nacho.
You're welcome.
Excellent. That is Nacho Amadoz, is it pronounced, I think?
Yes.
Thanks, Nacho, for joining us this evening. And hello to you, Michele. We've kind of started the podcast technology.ie this evening in a kind of an unorthodox way, playing around as we were this evening on Google Plus Hangouts and things like that. And then suddenly the conversation took off. We were talking about .cat and you gave Nacho a shout. Good evening to you, by the way, Michele, and welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Con. Sorry we missed out last week, but...
Not to worry. You were at ICANN in... where was it again?
Prague.
In Prague. How did that go?
It was a very, very busy week, which is part of the reason why I couldn't do anything about getting on for a recording or anything with you. I mean, as I've said in the past, I mean, the meeting officially runs from Monday onwards, But for some of us, it starts on the Saturday morning and we have meetings over the weekend. And this week was no different. There's a lot of stuff going on. You've got the new TLDs, which, of course, we've been talking about quite a bit. There's a new ICANN CEO who will be joining the organisation in October. There's the departure, was the departure of the current, well, he's no longer the current CEO, of Rod Beckstrom, who'd been the CEO for the last 3 years. And, of course, there's the ongoing discussions, debates, arguments around the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, a.k.a. the RAA. So it's a very, very, very busy week.
That's something you've been exercised about, and I know in particular the RAA. Michaela, did you make progress on that at this meeting?
Progress is something which I would love to be able to tie down. I mean, you know, you have conversations with people, and it was heartening to see, for example, a lot of the non-commercial users engaging actively with other parts of the community in relation to the RAA, kind of going, look, you know, there's some stuff here that we think is fundamentally wrong. It needs to be dealt with in a better fashion, et cetera, et cetera. But whether or not there's been any real progress in terms of rolling back some of the more abhorrent aspects of what people are asking for, it's too early to say. You know, the Registrar Stakeholder Group, of which we are a member, has been in negotiations for 7 months and put out some papers just before the meeting with a particular position on a variety of aspects. And, you know, our position on some of these things is just not going to change. We've made certain concessions. We can make concessions with respect to language, respect to, you know, various little bits and pieces. But certain fundamental issues, you know, we cannot concede any more than what we have.
So this is going to, I presume, drag on for a while. At some point, some kind of compromise or agreement will have to be reached. Is there a deadline for this?
No. There's no actual hard deadline. But there is a lot of pressure being put on registrars, the GAC, which are the governments that attend ICANN, with the exception of Ireland, who doesn't turn up. And there's certain parts of the community that have some serious issues with the current contract and want to see that changed. And a lot of the stuff they're asking for, to be perfectly honest with you, is fine. It's reasonable. It's not an issue. And we've agreed in principle to most of the things that people have asked for. I mean, some of them, I say, they're small things. It's the big stuff that's much, much, much harder to come to agreement on.
But the current agreement stays in place until a new one supersedes it, or until final agreement is reached on this, I presume.
Well, it's actually a bit more complicated than that, because the contracts have a term. So the 2009 REA, which is the current one used by a lot of registrars, if you'd signed that last week, you'd have that contract for the next 4 years.
I see.
So what they did the last time round, when they replaced the contract, ICANN offered registrars an incentive to switch. So that time round, they reduced our per transaction fee for registrations, transfers, and renewals by a few cents, which, you know, for a registrar such as ourselves, didn't make much difference, because the volumes we were dealing with at the time were negligible. It would make a bit of a difference to us now, but still, if the new contract contains some of the language that is in the current draft, I wouldn't be switching.
Okay.
I would switch.
But obviously it's going to come to a head for individual registrars, I presume, as they find themselves the term on their current contracts running out, and that's going to become an issue for them, I suppose.
Well, it depends on it all comes down to whatever's in the final contract.
Final contract, yeah. Okay.
Because, I mean, we're talking kind of around this without actually talking about it, I suppose. I mean, the demands that cause issues for registrars are things like demanding that we validate the registrant, in other words, the person who's registering a domain name, before the domain goes live. Now, the problem with that is that it'll slow down domain registrations significantly. So, like, you won't be able to as easily to go to a registrar's website, be that ours or one of our competitors, choose a domain name and register it quickly and easily. because you have to validate yourself with the registrar before the domain goes live. And there's also talk as well of an annual revalidation or re-verification process. And again, if you fail that for whatever reason, the domain could be suspended, which will, of course, kill off any services associated with it.
And this is the one of the things, essentially, Michele, that, as you say, as registrars, you're not going to concede, you're not going to give in on. Presumably, this you know, the other side will have to, ICANN will have to back down on this, will they? It's not so much ICANN, but the and the governments, isn't it, are the main people pressing for this?
Well, it's the law enforcement agencies have a list of recommendations, which they put through the governments, which then goes to ICANN. Mm. The problem is that whereas the law enforcement guys are going, hey, these are recommendations, and if you can do some of these things or choose which things you want to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then that's grand. But what seems to be happening is that ICANN's people have taken the view that registrars have to do everything. Which, of course, means that we're at loggerheads. But hey, you know, it's all fun and games until somebody loses an eye.
Speaking of law enforcement, Michele, you've posted a number of things on the notes that we're going to talk about this evening on the show. Among those, the latest Twitter transparency report.
Yeah, that was made for some interesting reading. I mean, this is, again, it's similar to the one that Google released a few weeks ago, where you've got data about which governments have asked them for information on users or actually to remove tweets. Mm. And you'll be happy to know the Irish government doesn't feature on the list. but you won't get any prizes for guessing which government is at the top of the list.
I'm just looking down through it. Oh, United States by a country mile. It's at the end of the list as I'm looking. Now, that's in relation to user information requests, which I would have thought is surprising. Does that reflect perhaps more the prevalence of Twitter in the United States as opposed to the interest in the United States from law enforcement on perhaps getting information on users? Or how do you interpret that?
Well, it's a bit hard to say because, I mean, without getting really granular data on what exactly was requested, you can only make, you know, suppositions. Because, you know, don't forget Twitter is an American company.
Yes.
So does that mean that some of these requests were from other government agencies, from government agencies from other countries that sent it through via the correct channels to their US counterparts? I'm not sure if that's clear or not. But also as well, yeah, of course, there's going to be more American users. And you know, it's very hard to say. But it's interesting to see that, you know, information about users, 679 versus 98 from Japan, and then the rest of them are down around the 10 or less mark.
10 or less is right, and that includes countries like Brazil, Bulgaria, Canada, France, Germany. Canada has 11, all the others less than 10 is how it's listed. User information request, and then it goes on to say the percentage where some of the or all of the information was produced in response to that request. 75% of that 679 user information requests in the United States were responded to positively and by some information being given. Japan, which stands out again as having 98 user information requests, 20% of those were responded to in a positive way. And then users or accounts specified. I'm not sure exactly what that column means there. It's interesting data anyway, without a doubt, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot. We're seeing this from Google, as you say, we're seeing it from Twitter as well. And these companies, they're trying to be transparent, I suppose, about how they respond to these requests.
Well, this is it. I mean, the reality is, you know, that as we've discussed ad nauseum in the past, I mean, there's this ongoing kind of, I don't know. It's like it's like a great big storm. It's never ending between, you know, getting that balance between, you know, government involvement, government oversight, government law enforcement requests, copyright stuff, intellectual property rights stuff. I mean, there's so much going on. I mean, have a look at, say, chillingeffects.org. It's absolutely fascinating, which is, you know, Chilling Effects, they, what they do is they give a lot of information about takedown requests, including DMCAs and others. And it's run by the Electric Frontier Foundation, Harvard, Stanford, Berkeley, University of San Francisco, etc., and a bunch of others. And Wendy Seltzer, who's a frequent attendee at ICANN meetings, is one of the people behind that. We were actually hoping to speak to her at some stage, but she's a hard woman to track down.
Busy, I'm sure. You've also posted a link, Michele, to internetdeclaration.org, a site which titles itself Declaration of Internet Freedom. There's a preamble there and a declaration which starts, "We stand for a free and open internet. We support transparency and participatory processes for making internet policy and the establishment of five basic principles, which are expression, don't censor the internet, access, promote universal access to fast and affordable networks, openness, keep the internet an open network where everyone is free to connect, communicate, write, read, watch, speak, listen, learn, create and innovate. Innovation, protect the freedom to innovate and create without permission. Don't block new technologies and don't punish innovators for their users' actions. And the final one of those five basic principles listed is privacy. Protect privacy and defend everyone's ability to control how their data and devices are used." Sounds like a good idea to express these principles in a declaration or in an abstract form like this. What's different about this, Michele? Hasn't this been done before? Isn't this the kind of thing like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others have done? Or are they involved with this declaration?
Well, it's something which has been signed up to by a large number of organizations and, you know, thought leaders. I mean, if you look at the list that's there at the moment, and that list will grow.
I see the EFF is in it, actually, yes.
Oh, yeah, of course they are. Of course they are. I mean, if you look down you know, it's split up into organizations, companies, and individuals. And on the main site here, you're going to find the organizations, the bigger ones. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, looking at the list here, you've got, who have you got? I'm trying to write, like Boxy, who you might be familiar with, Cheeseburger, as in, you know, I can has cheeseburger.
Yeah. I think it's interesting looking at the list of companies, the companies that aren't there, and maybe it kind of reflects the difficulties there can be for corporates in relation to, I suppose, committing themselves to a position such as this. And, you know, very often I'm talking about in particular, Google isn't here, Facebook isn't here, Twitter isn't here on this list either. And we know that if you were to ring up their corporate head office, they would say, well, we respect the laws of the countries we operate in. And that's kind of, you know, that's one of the issues and one of the, you know, they sometimes do take positions like this, political positions, but in general, taking a political position isn't often seen as good business.
It's something that a lot of companies have to struggle with. I mean, for us, we do take positions. I'll clearly state that. I mean, we have signed up to this. We have our name is not published on the list as yet, and I've no idea when it will appear, right, but we have signed up to it. Another one of the registrars has signed up as well. I can see Two Cows is listed on there.
I see it is, yeah.
There's other companies like Reddit's on there, SEO Moz is on there, Tech Dirt is on there, and there's a load of others. I mean, if you look at the list of actual individuals,
that's interesting. Yeah.
Now, some of those names you might recognise, others you might not. But, you know, there's going to be enough in there that you'll recognise. Like Cory Doctorow is in there.
Neil Gaiman just underneath him there on the list. Several other people like that.
Vint Cerf is in there.
And that's interesting. I mean, Vint Cerf works for Google, does he not?
Yeah, but Vince Cerf had a life before Google.
No, I agree. But and again, this just shows the distinction that individuals and I suppose technology heroes such as Vince Cerf can support this on an individual basis. Probably Sergey and Larry might well decide that they could support this on an individual basis as well. But committing your publicly traded company to it is a whole different matter involving shareholders and boards and things. Like that as well.
TwoCat is a publicly traded company.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying that it's a slower machine to move. In your case, Michele, you're a relatively small company and Black Knight in Ireland, and you know you've made a decision as a company to sign up for this. But again, you don't have thousands of shareholders and
I know. Yeah. I mean, look. The thing is this. I mean, let's not get too bogged down on this. I mean. Ultimately, you know, certain companies are going to sign up for this. And, you know, part of the reason why this kind of thing came about is because, you know, you've had Soka, you've had Pipa, ACTA, which was killed off by the European Parliament earlier today. Mm. But don't for a minute think that that ACTA is the last one or that SOPA was the last one. There's going to be something else coming around the corner. Might not be this week, might not be next month. But you can be sure there'll be something else. A different version of it will appear.
So
worried.
So why do you, as an internet business, as Black Knight Solutions, Michele, why did you decide that this is something that you want to support and be involved with?
Well, I mean, it's to me, the ethos, the underlying statement that's being made there, I mean, it's summed up in one sentence. We stand for a free and open internet. And that, to me, is key. Without a free and open internet, I wouldn't be able to do what I do and how I do it. I wouldn't be able. We would not be able to Skype with Nacho in Barcelona this evening if you had a situation where ISPs and others along the way decided, you know, block Skype or other technologies because it was competing too effectively with other companies. You know, these are the kind of threats that we're seeing all the time. So for me, it's a no-brainer.
Is it a business decision or a political decision?
Well, I think they're the same thing. I mean, this is a philosophy. You know, it's a. Mm. I mean, some companies have, you know, a statement of some kind about what they stand for, what they'll do and what they won't do. We don't. Maybe we should. But I'm not too sure how we'd fit cats and dragons into all that. But anyway, you know, the thing is, I'm a strong believer in all of these things here. I mean, note as well, it doesn't say, please go off and rip off other people's copyright. Please go and download the latest movies via torrent. You know, please make illegal copies of the latest CDs. It doesn't say that. Mm. It says, you know, expression, don't censor the internet. How can you possibly argue against that? I mean, on what planet would I, as a hosting provider and domain registrar and everything else, possibly not agree with that statement?
Because what you're saying, really, Michele, it makes business sense as well as everything else. The internet, as far as you're concerned, is a place where you can get things done, where you can create new technology, where you can innovate, where you can make things happen, and that's what business is about. And in particular, it's what your business is about.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's what our users do, and you know, the last thing I want is to spend you know, an hour or two every day wading through spurious takedown notices because somebody doesn't like something that somebody else said on the internet. You know, that is the kind of rubbish that just is a massive waste of my time, my clients' time, and everybody else's time. You know, there are serious issues both online and offline. Let's deal with those. Let's not make laws that, you know, hinder our freedom of expression, freedom of access, that stop the internet from being open and available to all.
Let's take a break. We're going to talk in part two about Facebook recognising same-sex unions on the same in the same month and on the same day that it seems it could be becoming a political issue here in Ireland. I've posted a link to that as well, Michele. Carrion drops lawsuit against the oatmeal. We've talked about this a few weeks ago and there's more to talk about it. I think it seems to be finally resolved and wound up. Google Plus, let's talk about that as well, Michele, because there's some interesting things going on with Google. It seems to be extending its tentacles in all kinds of directions, into calendars and into Google Plus and all kinds of interesting stuff happening there. And some people not too pleased with that. Some people not too pleased with Facebook either. And we salute and say au revoir to Minitel. What are you plugging this week, or what are you offering, Michele? It's the .cat special offer. That's our main thing this week, isn't it?
Totally. .cat. We let the cat out of the bag.
And we'll put a link to that on the website at technology.ie.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
You're listening to technology.ie with Con and Michele. Lots to talk about this week. We started it rather unconventionally with a impromptu Skype call to Barcelona, and our thanks to Nacho for that this evening. .cat domain names, you can get them for $9.99 at Black Knight. For the first 300 only, isn't that right, Michele?
Yes, it is. Very special good. Offer. Limited quantities available. Get them while they're hot.
Have you tried out your Facebook email address yet, Michele? Did you know you had one, by the way?
I did, and I disabled it as soon as it was turned on.
Okay, so how do you disable it?
You can go into your profile. Sorry, I'm just going to go to my Facebook account now so I can actually do this.
Sure.
If you go to your Facebook profile,
yes,
and you click on, I think it's update info.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to contact info.
Okay, yes.
Click on edit.
Yes.
And what you then do is you mark the facebook.com email address as hidden from timeline.
Okay.
So it's, if you're looking at your email addresses, you'll have the first one. The first item will show whether it's showing to friends, public, only me, or custom.
Right.
Or to a specific list or something. And then the icon further over, it's either to show it on the timeline or not to show it on the timeline.
This, they just rolled it out. Everyone suddenly discovered that the primary email address listed on their profiles was, in my case, conomwinacoin@facebook.com, which is, well, fine, but I didn't ask for it, and I haven't disabled it. I haven't hidden it from the timeline. As I say, I've just only checked it out a few minutes before we started recording the podcast this evening. In fact, Michele, I tested it. I've sent an email address to it, and nothing has shown up, which is kind of, well, you know, makes you wonder what's the point, really, in a way. And it sort of ties in with the experience people are having. This has been rolled out worldwide to Facebook users, and it doesn't work.
Well, whether it works or not is one thing. The fact that they turned it on by default is a much more serious issue.
But they do that all the time, Michele. What are you complaining about? You know, quit griping. This is Facebook. It's what they do.
Ah, no, hold on. See, the thing is this, is that one thing is when they display or don't display some bit of content or rejig it in some fashion. Mm. It's another thing when they start messing about with your contact details. Like for some people, the only way I have of finding their email address in a hurry is going to be either via their LinkedIn profile or their Facebook profile.
And not only that, but people who use mobile devices with Facebook apps installed on it and things like that may find, and this has been reported in the last couple of days as well, in some cases, they're finding that they can't find the proper email address and it's been overwritten by this Facebook one.
Well, this is it. I mean, the change that they pushed out, it wasn't just cosmetic. I mean, it also messes about with people's address books. And, you know, that's a major issue. Now, you're saying it doesn't work properly. I hadn't even tested it. As soon as I became aware that Facebook had unilaterally, without my permission, changed my email address to be something that I had not signed up for and did not want, I changed it back.
For you and I, Michele, for you and me and people like us, this is just another, it's rather than seeing it as a major issue, I see it as just another nail in the coffin of how we begin to regard Facebook, i.e. we regard it with some suspicion, I think, very often. And I find it not a very, not a place that I'm comfortable interacting with people. Twitter, for example, is someplace I'm much more comfortable. Even Google Plus I'm starting to like a lot, even though it's becoming pervasive, and we'll talk about that in a little more. It's spreading into, the Google Plus experience is extending beyond Google Plus into just about everything you can imagine doing online. But for most people, they're not going to notice.
No, not until they run into a problem.
Yeah.
And that's it. But it's one of those things. It's like it was rolled out, but nobody was told.
Yeah.
I mean, other times they made changes and they announced it in some fashion. You know, there was some kind of notification when you logged in. Hey, you know, new feature. Hey, do you want to preview this feature or whatever? This is Zuckerberg being, I don't know, I'm lost for words. I mean, I can't think of anything polite to say about it.
What's been the response? The criticism has been pretty much universal. But what has been the response on that? Has it been a response from Facebook?
I honestly don't know. I haven't actually seen it.
No, I don't think so as well. There hasn't been. I'm just looking now down through it at the moment. CBS News reporting that Facebook are working on a fix for the email address swap. The fix sounds pretty obvious, I think, to me and you, and you've just suggested that they should roll back this whole thing for a start. But that is something that it's yet another backfire on them. They may have gone too far this time, but I suspect not, Michaela. I think they're just going to carry on regardless, and people will forget about it. Not that they should, but it's what will happen. Google Plus, I've been talking about, Michele. The Google Plus events has been rolled out as a new feature, and an interesting one, and one which has caught the imagination of some people I follow on Google Plus in particular, because one of the great geek meetups which I've been proud to be involved with over the last 5 years, and one which has kind of stood the test of time while other things have come and gone, has been Limerick Open Coffee Club, which meets on the first Thursday of every month in used to be in the Clarion Hotel in Limerick. It's for the last several years it's been in the Absolute Hotel in Limerick, and they look after us very well there, and it's a great gathering of entrepreneurs, people involved in startups, not perhaps on the scale of the originally envisioned Open Coffee Club. I think it was started in London. You know, you don't see a lot of venture capitalists there, but you do occasionally, and I think there's one or two people turning up tomorrow that might have some advice to offer. As I say, we turn up to it informally, we occasionally tweet about it, but this time Bernie Goldbach, who's very active of course on the internet in Ireland, on social media and on Google Plus in particular, when Google Plus Events was launched a couple of weeks ago, or about just over a week or two ago, he set up an event for this week's Open Coffee Club, which I say is going on tomorrow, and invited all of the usual suspects to it. And it's been interesting, because it's been, for a change, as I say, we generally just turn up. We don't tend to talk or tweet much about it beforehand. But there has been a lot of talk about it, and there's talk of setting up a Google Plus Hangout in association with it tomorrow at the event itself. And people are just, I suppose, interested in how this, you know, this new aspect of Google Plus, how this events thing works, how it populates your calendar, although some people have been complaining about that as well. And also, they've had these nice animated covers. Have you seen those, Michele?
No, because no. I mean, being perfectly honest, over the last week with being in Prague at the ICANN meeting, running between meetings all the time, then came back and, you know, the usual.
Well, for example, I set one up this evening for you and I. I set it up as a Google Plus event, and if you look, it's a kind of a picnic scene. I chose from one of the featured covers provided. But if you look, you can see that there's a little bit of animation subtly in it as well, which has kind of caught people's imagination. The one for the Limerick Open Coffee features people actually occasionally taking a drink or pouring some champagne into a glass as well.
Where's the animation in it? Look, I can't see it.
I'm just looking now at the moment. I'll bring it up while we're talking. Can you see the picnic scene, yeah?
Yes.
And if you look at the grass in the foreground on the right-hand side, or the...
Oh, right. Click right into it. Sorry. Yes.
Oh, you have to click into it, do you, for it to work?
Yeah, sorry, I hadn't spotted that. Yeah, that's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, no, it's just as I say, people have been playing with that and noticing that over the last while. But Google Plus is kind of spreading out a little bit, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, it's inevitable. I mean, what they did, they merged Google Places into Google Plus a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So now, if you go on the left hand side, you can click on local. And that will take you into the reviews local stuff, which is basically an extension from Google Maps. Mm. And what was actually kind of cool was that they magically redirected all of the stuff from a person from a company's Google Place through to this new thing. Mm. So if you actually go into for some reason, it thinks I'm in Stillorgan. I don't know why it thinks I'm in Stillorgan. It must be my IP address or something. I don't know. If you go into our one, for example, you'll find all our reviews and everything else are there. So you can go into Black Knight Internet Solutions Limited, and it's all there.
It's something I'm going to be paying more attention to. As you know, Michaela, I've started a new job as manager of a community radio station in West Clare, and their social media and internet public relations strategy is in its infancy. It's started and kicked off, and they've been getting a great response on Twitter and Facebook pages in particular. But definitely Google Plus is something we're going to be integrating into that now, I think, in the coming weeks. And especially the whole notion of the places, Google Places, I think, as well, because the particular company is, it's location based. It's centred around the towns of Kilrush and Kilkee in West Clare, and it's going to be something that we're going to be doing and encouraging people to drop into us.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. If the product, service, or business that you're involved with is local, I mean, if you can say, right, this is targeting this specific area, then that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's just logical to me.
Same-sex marriage makes a lot of sense to a lot of people, including tarnished Eamon Gilmore, who voiced his support for it at the weekend. But I saw newspaper headlines today saying that Taoiseach Enda Kenny is perhaps not so enthusiastic about it, and it was quoting some policy statements, I think, or some opinions he had voiced several years ago before he became Taoiseach and got into government. But Facebook has no qualms about supporting it, and if you are in a same-sex relationship, you can express that in many ways, and in the fullest way possible, indeed, in terms of your relationship status.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. I mean, you can now say two men can now get married on Facebook, and that will be reflected in the relationship status. Which, I mean, actually, stepping back from this a second, I mean, this conversation is totally insane, that a social network can decide whether or not same-sex marriage is possible or not is just such a bizarre concept. But it's all down to the icons. I mean, that's all it's down to. It's like it now accepts the possibility that two men, or I assume two women, because I haven't seen two, but hey, I must actually check. Do any of my lesbian friends, have any of my lesbian friends actually got married on Facebook?
You've linked to a story on Mashable, headlined Facebook adds same-sex marriage icons for couples. It's referring to the feature was noticed over the weekend when Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes married his partner Sean Eldridge. An icon of two grooms was added to Hughes' Facebook timeline to announce their wedding news. Well, I suppose if you're a co-founder of Facebook, you can certainly influence how Facebook supports your lifestyle choice in this case. And also, of course, Facebook CEO and co-founder Mark Zuckerberg was appropriately enough one of among 1,800 members that liked Hughes' status update. But I think, Michaela, it comes back to what I was saying with Nacho earlier, is that whatever about laws and status and those things are important, and they're important to people in gay relationships as well, and particularly important for all kinds of human rights and civil rights issues. issues. But when it comes to online, you can express yourself in any way that you choose and really lead societal changes, really, in terms of is what Facebook can do. And when I was talking to Nacho, I was really saying that in terms of what culture and what language and what identity you identify with, there are no restrictions on the internet, and it perhaps could be a model for society in the sense that I can choose to speak Irish or Catalan, I can choose to be in a gay relationship or otherwise, and it doesn't and shouldn't affect other internet users. Maybe there's a lesson there for society as well.
Well, this comes back to the Internet Declaration of Freedom, I mean, that we talked about at the bit earlier on.
Doesn't it just?
I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, ultimately, if you're not doing any harm to anybody else, who cares? You know, live and let live. And, you know, that this is the thing, you know, that you see time and again when it comes to, you know, the internet. You know, you can do whatever you want as long as you're not negatively impacting other people.
I think it's positive, and I think I'm talking about in general, I suppose, the theme that we seem to have slipped into for the programme this evening, that live and let live, as you say, Michele. And when it comes to things like, you know, even copyright infringement and copyright and, you know, using content on the internet and things like this, ACTA, you've pointed out, was killed by the EU Parliament. That's finally not going to go any further, in spite of the fact that it had been negotiated in secret, as we know, and signed up to. It's not a positive thing, and it's not a positive step, and it's interesting to see that in the cold light of day of transparency and parliamentary democracy, it has in fact been defeated under that kind of scrutiny. Something I wanted to bring up, and I didn't put it in the notes, but I had personal experience of it this week. IMRO, the Irish Music Rights Organisation, whom we've talked about before, have in fact in the last week or two, because I've been watching this for a while, and I actually spoke to someone in IMRO during the week, they have clarified and they have simplified their online music licensing to the extent that it is now possible, and I'll let you know in a week or two how possible it is, because I'm going to be launching a music podcast or basically on a business basis, or my company is going to be providing this for a friend of mine who's involved with music. He's a musician himself. He's also a very popular radio DJ and presenter, and we're going to try and take his radio show, where he has a real style in terms of selecting, choosing and presenting music. We're going to try and take that and publish that as a podcast. We can actually do that legally and with the in a licensed way, thanks to these new podcast licenses which have been provided by IMRO. I'll let you know if we trip up on that, Michele, but it's a much more positive step, I have to say, than I would have imagined, say, 5-6 years ago when podcasting got underway. And the official position, indeed, for many years has been that podcasting equals piracy.
Yeah, and I mean, it's about time that some of these organizations got with the plan. You know, I mean, they need to be moving with the times. They need to be realize that they can't apply the old licensing models as easily as they could in the past. That doesn't mean, you know, throw out copyright. It means adapt copyright.
Make new models.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no reason why not. I mean, again, I'll come back. We've said this before, and I'll say it again. Killa, for example, or how do you pronounce it? Keela?
Yes, I think so. I'm not sure.
They were so easy to work with when they, with respect to the licensing on the music we used at the beginning of this podcast.
Yes.
And, you know, perfect. It was simple. It was straightforward. There was no complications. Great. Hmm. But, I mean, we've seen this happen with other things where, you know, something that you thought was grand, it turns out there was a problem. So, for example, we had to change the whole music we use in the office because it turns out that there was some issue with the licensing. You know, it's silly. It's just, you know, we're not trying to break any laws, and you're trying to actually stay within the laws, and you find that it's made difficult.
Eventually, though, I suppose this is what we're saying, at whether it's gay marriage or music licensing or whatever it is, progress gets made, and hopefully it'll get made with the registrar accreditation agreement as well, Michele, that you're working on. Couple of more things we want to get to, and we want to finish up the podcast as soon as we can this evening. There's a lot to talk about. I'm going to talk to you about Minitel, and so we'll say au revoir to Minitel, which was a pioneer.
Did you ever use one? Did you ever use them?
I did, would you believe, and I was in France, in Brittany, on an exchange in 1984, which, when you think of it, Michele, was so many years ahead of, really a whole decade ahead of, when many people in general use and in general in Ireland, for example, encountered anything such as an online service. It was quite extraordinary. And again, when I say 1984, I was in secondary school. I hadn't even conceived of the internet. I hadn't seen, for example, networked dumb terminals in a mainframe. I hadn't gone to college yet at that stage. My only familiarity with computers was with your 8-bit systems, the type of PCs the type of home computers that we had in the early 1980s. And yet, I was in France, and I think we were checking my return sailing back with Brittany Ferries at the time. And Maman, in the home in which I was staying in the city of Rennes, went into a kind of an office room that they had and pulled out the Minitel and said, "This is how we'll check it." And I was really amazed and astonished. It reminded me, looking back, and it was like this long cathode ray tubes type system. You took off the front cover, which doubled as a keyboard. It reminded me of what I later came to see was an oscilloscope. They were just like those kind of things, really, weren't they?
Well, I mean, I lived in France for several years, and we used to use Minitel for things like checking metro connections.
Yes.
So you could say, you could dial into the RATP's system, say, you know, okay, I want to go from Ballard to, I don't know, Le Mont Piqué Grenelle, which is a very simple, straight line, but hey, who cares? I mean, you could put in, you know, where you were starting, where you were going, and it would tell you where you had to change. It would tell you other bits and pieces. Of course, also as well, it was how they introduced a whole kind of pay-per-use system there as well. So a lot of these 3615 numbers you'd dial up on Minitel, and you'd be charged several francs a minute.
It was essentially a bulletin board system, Michele, wasn't it?
Well, it had multiple facets. I mean, it was a bulletin board system. It was it was a system you could use to interactively query it for things. You could use it for booking flights. You could book, train tickets, check the timetables for cinemas.
When are we talking about here?
It started in 1982.
Right. And when did you use it? When were you living in France?
I was there from beginning of 1992 for about 3 years.
Right. So really, as the web was kicking off, it's astonishing to think that it was still working up until a few days ago.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if my aunt still has a Minitel device sitting around her flat. She probably does. It's probably buried underneath some junk in a corner somewhere, or maybe it's been shoved in the basement. But pretty much every single flat and house in France would have had one of these.
Wow.
And, you know, if you look at the Guardian article that you linked to, you know, that's a particular model of the Minitel. I think there were a number of different models available, and they were simple, yet they were effective. I mean, they just worked. You know, you just put in the number of the service, and you'd see all the ads everywhere. You're like, 3615, whatever. I mean, it could be a keyword.
It had a lot in common with another 1980s technology, which was Airtel or CFAX, or what do we call it, Teletext.
Yeah.
Similar in many ways to that. I'm looking at the Guardian article that I've linked to in the notes this week. France says farewell to the Minitel, the little box that connected a country, precursor to the internet, now redundant after 30 years. And here's something I didn't know, Michele. Chunky terminals, popular for cyber sex and accounts.
Well, I didn't want to mention it, but yes. It was very, very popular. There were a lot of sex lines advertised all over France using 3615 numbers.
Right.
So
the number you would dial, you would actually dial to a number and connect to a Minitel computer that would and be charged according to the type of number you had dialed. Is that how it worked?
Yeah.
I see.
So, I mean, you'd dial up. I mean, if you actually go if you go onto Google and do a search for Minitel or something like that, you'll probably find quite a few images. Let me see if I can bring up some here whilst we're talking. Like if you chuck Minitel into Google Image Search, you'll get back hundreds and hundreds of images of the various different terminals that they had. And like, you know, it's here, for example, I'm looking at an image, you know, 3615 Désir d'Avenir, Ségolène Royal. It's from her, so this was, you know, this, it's, you know, it was used.
That she was the presidential candidate, was she not? Yes.
Ségolène Royal actually had a Minitel homepage. So you'd like, you could dial into it.
Right.
So I'm not sure what the address would have been. Like, yeah. It's probably 36 whatever, and, you know, you'd put in the rest of it. But, I mean, it was pretty cool technology at the time. It was way further ahead of the teletext stuff that we were dealing with, CFAX and of the Irish one, Airtel. I mean, I don't know, is Airtel still going or has it been killed off as well?
I imagine it is. I've given up watching television almost entirely. Just kind of in reference, I suppose, to all of that, it was interesting that the Minitel system in the home in which I stayed in Wren in 1984 was something that the mother of the household was very, very comfortable using. But the guy my own age, whom I exchanged with on that one, was a total computer head. And I remember visiting Computer Club in the centre of Wren, and it was something that was a real l'informatique, as it is known in France. There was a big culture in the 1980s of, I was quite impressed with, and much more advanced, I think, than my early experiments with computers were at the time. It's not something we often think about, but the French are very into IT.
They are. I mean, they have a pretty good infrastructure, and you know, there is a lot of going on there. Now, comparatively, they wouldn't be as big, say, as some of the other European countries, like the Netherlands or Germany, where it's just insane. Like, I look at, you know, the number of domain names registered per head of population, the concentration in some of those countries is absolutely off the charts. But yeah, you know, it's you know, France had a lot of stuff.
Absolutely.
And it was pretty cool.
Let's wrap things up. I'm going to ask you about that oatmeal lawsuit in a moment, Michele. But first, have you heard anything? We'll just very briefly touch on it. This Google Nexus Q announced at Google I.O. sounds interesting. Or have you found out much about it?
Only what you sent it via LinkedIn. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a bit like a. It strikes me as being a bit like, say, Apple TV, as it, you know, that hockey puck thing at the moment that you can get. This is actually has even more of a sports metaphor. It looks like a ball, some kind of an orb, is how it's been described. I've linked to an article in Gizmodo, and I'm quoting from it. This isn't a device for streaming media off of your phone, like HTC's Media Link. The Nexus Q pulls content directly from the internet via Wi-Fi or internet, or Ethernet, I should say, and you use your phone or tablet to control it. It's something I think I'm going to be, you know, maybe looking into and finding out a little bit more about it. And another thing, I've linked to an article as well in Engadget, which points out that Google Q breaks the mold somewhat in terms of these kind of devices, in that it's not only designed in the United States, it is entirely manufactured there as well. But we'll come back to that, I think, again, when both of us have had a chance to find out a bit more about it. The oatmeal story you brought up a couple of weeks ago, Michele, there's been further developments in that.
Yeah, this is really just the most bizarre thing ever.
Remind us of the background again.
Well, okay, go back about 12 to 18 months ago, the Oatmeal published a blog piece going on about how another website was basically ripping off the content. And
This guy was ripping off his content, so he blogged about it, and then the guy threatened to sue.
Not quite.
Yes.
What happened was the guy from the Oatmeal blogged about another a website ripping off his content. And then a few weeks ago, the lawyer acting for the other website tried to get money out of the guy behind the Oatmeal. And the guy from the oatmeal dealt with it legally and everything through his legal counsel, but then publicly went on to say that he had absolutely zero intention of paying them any damages, and that he would collect the $20,000 that they're asking for, withdraw it, photograph it, and send them a photograph of the money. And he would donate all the money to charity.
Shades of Mel Gibson there in the ransom. And in fact, people started sending him contributions towards this and greatly exceeded that $20,000 that the guy had tried to extort.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like, I think it's like over $200,000. It was a lot more.
So the latest thing then was the guy who's called what's his name, Carrion.
Carrion, who's the legal counsel acting for Funny. What the hell was the name of the website? Funny something. Hold on, I should actually know this off the top of my head. But you see, the thing is, at this stage, the fact that I can't remember that website, it's just, you know, Carrion took the thing and blew it completely out of proportion. And not only tried to sue the oatmeal, but tried to sue everybody else. So trying to sue not only the oatmeal, but all the charities that were going to receive the donations.
And tried to get an injunction to stop the oatmeal guy from actually collecting the money which had been pledged to him or had been sent to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely insane. I mean, absolutely no rhyme or reason or logic. And you see, this guy, Carrion, you know, the court filings he made were, well, how can I put it? I mean, he's probably sue me if I say anything too much.
We won't say anything. We're scaredy cats.
This guy, he seems to have to be a repeat offender. And what he did is he was trying to sue everybody.
Yeah.
And was very, very gung-ho about the entire thing.
Mm.
And then a couple of days ago, turns around and withdraws his court case, but does it in such a fashion that he still retains the right to sue again in the future if he wants.
And he's claimed victory in relation to it as well. But should the guy can say what he's like? It's trolling, Michele, as we've said before.
Oh, it's totally trolling. I mean, the guy, anyway, is Charles Carrion.
Mm. And the website is Funny Junk.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, Carrion is, well, he's fairly high profile. I mean, he was born in Phoenix, Arizona. He's done, what was he represented? I mean, he's American Buddha. He's represented Funny Junk. I think the Funny Junk thing is just got him a huge amount of attention. And the Funny Junk legal dispute now has its very own article on Wikipedia.
Well, there you go. There you go. We don't have an article on Wikipedia yet, but you can find us on the web at technology.ie. Maybe somebody will write one. We can't write it ourselves. That's the way it works, isn't it, Michele?
Oh, God, yes. No. Oh, there's another one. He's suing. Oh, wait for it. In June, a critic of Carrion set up the satirical site charles-carrion.com.
So he's gone suing them as well?
Yes. And it's interesting because Paul Levy of Public Citizen will be representing satirical Charles, who is...
As opposed to real Charles.
Well, presumably, yeah. Paul Levy, that name sounds familiar. I think I've heard of that. I've come across that guy. No, I mean, the thing is this. It's just, you know, you just have to there kind of scratch your head and just kind of wonder to yourself, you know, who in their right mind would try to sue, like, everybody for something like that. It makes no sense. No sense whatsoever.
That's the weird and wonderful world of the internet. And Michele, we're going to leave it there for this week. Thanks for joining us on the podcast on technology.ie. We'll do it again next week at the same time.